You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and as you can probably hear from my voice, I am in the sort of critical hungover condition that one gets in at the end of the Montreal Comedy Festival when one has spent the entire week working hard, recording podcasts, doing shows, getting all stressed about TV taping, doing that, everything working out well, and then going out and getting smashed for the first time, and then suddenly waking up, as a young man might do in the flush of summer, and thinking, oh God, I've done absolutely nothing about releasing a podcast today. I've been a little bit confused as which ones to put out, and I've gone with George Egg for today. He's absolutely brilliant, and I want to make sure that you guys know all about him before his Edinburgh show. This is a podcast I recorded a couple of weeks ago. As you'll hear, George came round to my flat, and we did the first half of the interview. Then he cooked me a lovely dinner, a lovely lunch, as we'll go into more detail as you'll hear. It was fantastic. He's an amazing cook. And then we did the second half of the interview, all with lovely full tummies. Now, the reason we did this is not just because George is a lovely man and offers kind things like that, and anyone would be a fool to turn down dinner from him, but George is doing a show called Anarchist Cook at Edinburgh, which you'll hear all about, but it's all tied in and thematic, and it was a lovely suggestion of George to come around and do it. So we'll go to that podcast here. I'll bring you that interview in just 1 second, but here's me going, well, what order do I put everything out in? Guys, I've got too many podcasts. I'm drowning in pods. And I want to get all of the people out that are coming to Edinburgh, including George, of course, and then Charlie Baker, who I recorded live at Latitude. He's doing an Edinburgh show as well. And Justin Morehouse is going to be up there. So I've got those three in the chamber. I've got to get them out. But I've just done some fabulous episodes up here with Jen Kirkman, with Moshe Kasher, and with the incredible Patton Oswalt, which I recorded yesterday and is a strong contender for best ever podcast. I mean, it certainly is. If you one of my ones, I mean, best ever at all in any media, best thing that's ever happened. And certainly of these episodes, it's a real favourite of mine because Patton's sort of he's kind of basically my favourite comic. And it just went swimmingly well. I'll bring you that as soon as I can. I want to keep things current and bring out the Montreal ones. It would be lovely to have done it while I was here, but I've just been too busy. I've got 1 day left here, and I'm going to spend that trotting around, seeing shows and doing more recordings. So this is George Egg. I don't want any of that to detract from George. My point is, I'm so desperate for you to see George that I'm going to prioritise the Edinburgh ones so that they can get maximum coverage and you can all go and see George, Justin's, and Charlie's Edinburgh shows. So here's George, and I'll let the rest of this interview speak for itself, and I'll speak to you somewhere around the middle, at which point, well, no real time will have passed for me, so I will sound as rough as I do now. This is the brilliant George Egg. We're going to do this in an unusual way as well. This was your idea. Tell my listeners how we're going to run this interview.
Well, we're going to do half of it, and then we're going to have a little break for lunch, and I'm going to cook you a nice lunch, and then we're going to do the second half replete.
This is such a great idea, and this is thematic. You could tell us why this is particularly thematic for you.
Well, because in the last couple of years, I have, I suppose, married my two passions, which is performing and cooking, and have started cooking on stage.
Now, this came about because of the Hotel Survival series, didn't it?
Yes.
That's the origin for it. Now, tell us about that, because I've mentioned that on numerous podcasts. Tell me, in your words, what Hotel Survival was, because the idea just tickles me.
I remember you doing a thing with the little net bag.
Oh, the pasta.
Yes, the pasta.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Inspired, I assume.
Absolutely.
By my work.
In fact, before you tell us what the Hotel Survivor is, just tell us briefly your kind of your comedy experience. You're a prop comic. Would you call yourself a prop comic?
Yes, definitely. Well, I started. I think this is why this is going to be, I hope, an interesting one, because we've got a very similar the path that we took into becoming circuit comedians is very similar, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Right down to our chaos, you watching it on a video, didn't you?
And I
saw it live. I worked there, in fact.
Okay. Hang on. It's so that I'm keen that I want the audience to know, because I fear sometimes that my listeners are very choosy. And I think occasionally I'll have had street performers on in the past, people with a street performing background. And I fear, I don't know if I'm right about this, I have this kind of anxiety that my listeners go, oh, he's done the street performer chat.
Absolutely.
It's very much not that, is it? Tell us who you are right now as a gigging comic, and then we'll talk about Hotel Survival, and then we'll talk about the background.
I am presently, I suppose, I describe myself as a prop comic. Although I always, for my whole career as a stand-up, I've hated that label, just because I know that it immediately turns a lot of people off, and they think, oh, so you're not a stand-up.
You're not a real
thing. Yeah. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm a stand-up who illustrates quite a lot of the jokes with objects, with props. But there's still jokes, and it's still, the whole format is very much like a stand-up set, with observational stuff and surreal stuff and stupid stuff and so on.
If you didn't have any props with you at all, if your car broke down, and I've touched a nerve there because I know we've got van issues, we'll get into them this time. We'll maybe get into them over dinner. But if you lost all of your props, if all of your gear was stolen, how much could you do time-wise with no props? Has that ever happened?
Well, it's not happened by accident, but I've done stand-up. I've done straight stand-up gigs by design. You know, I've been asked to do a gig and a shorter set, you know, so maybe 10, 15 minutes.
Okay.
But
okay.
I've got a battery of you know, just spoken word comedy.
Gotcha.
I suppose in a kind of club environment, if I suddenly realised that I'd bought the wrong
briefcase.
then I guess, yes, I could do 10, 15 minutes. But then with the cooking thing, I could do...
Yes.
I could just keep going.
Okay. And the kind of... What I'd like my listeners to understand is, I don't know if people know what we mean by prop comedy. Like, who are your contemporaries? Who are the other people on the circuit doing... Because you're not a magician. There's one or two magic effects.
There's one or two tricks, but I would never... Away. Yeah, I would never call myself a magician, because also it's such a closed circle... the kind of magic fraternity, and I think that because some of the tricks I do, I expose, and some of the tricks I do, I don't do very well. I think that, you know, other magicians would go, he's not a magician.
Sure,
you know, if anything, I'd be worse than just a non-magician, anti-magician.
It's more just kind of like a sort of lunatic toy box of stuff. Do you think that's fair? I mean, the things that most like, if I was to describe your act to someone, I'd go, oh, there's that bowling ball gag at the beginning, which is a big, funny, massive prop that just makes people go, oh my god, anything can happen. And then the one that I always tell people about is Daily Thompson Olympics, which I know you don't do anymore.
I've done that for years. Everyone grew up.
Oh my god. So you would get the computer console, the keyboard of a Spectrum 48K, which is near to my heart, because I had that computer, if not that game. And you would do impressions of games on the Spectrum.
Yes, which I suppose, if we're being sort of comedically analytical, is really like your kind of Peter Kay who remembers big bottles of pop, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Well,
I mean, it's kind
I suppose it is.
Which
I
is kind of why I... That's not why I stopped doing it. I stopped doing that because... Mainly because you know, every time I get it out, fewer and fewer people would recognise
it. Yeah, initially there'd be a cheer.
I'm 42, yeah, yeah. And my audience probably is generally, certainly on the circuit, younger now.
And this is a computer, for those people that don't know what a Spectrum 48K is, it sort of has less memory than my watch.
Yeah.
You need to plug a cassette recorder into it and load games
on
analog.
And still tons more memory than they used to send people to the moon. So it's just insane, that, isn't it? Just the whole memory thing is bonkers. Yeah. Yes, and I suppose it was a computer that was around in the 80s,
yeah,
wasn't it, when I was
growing
up?
So you do that.
Well, don't do that.
No, you don't do that anymore. Sorry, no. I'm kind of just trying to sort of pick out certain bits of my favourites, like the LP covers.
Yeah, the LP covers. I like things like the travel pillow.
Yeah, the travel. Yes, pillow. Yeah. So you've got a range just of impressions.
It's more the stupidity of thinking that I've come up with a bright idea. The joke, I suppose, I'll explain for people wondering what we're talking about. I talk about performing gigs all over the country and spending a lot of time doing nighttime driving and finding that you can get quite tired and your head can start to droop down. And then saying, but I always come prepared because I carry around one of these and I've got a travel pillow.
Yeah.
And I say, if you don't know what this is a travel pillow. Genius idea. You can put it around your neck if you're tired while you're driving and just rest your head on it. And so that's the sort of thing that appeals to me more, that sort of prop joke where it's...
It's a visualisation of a sort of cartoon-esque idea.
Everyone would be going, that's not.
Yeah.
That's if anything, that's going to make it more dangerous.
Yeah, lovely. Lovely. You've got a big bag full of stuff and you're just kind of picking up and doing little twiddly ideas with things. And there is a parallel with our kind of backgrounds there, because you do, like, you're able to work silent. You can work...
not for long.
Well, but you can work non-English audiences.
Yes. And I have done a lot of that. And certainly, I still, in my circuit... act start the show with sort of 4 or 5 minutes of non-verbal comedy.
Non-verbal, I said non-English now, I sort of meant non-English speaking visual material,
of all visual stuff.
And didn't you at one point, you had a promotional giveaway which was sort of a recording of your first 4 minutes?
Yes, and I should redo that.
You must reissue it.
I know, yeah, it was a CD single of George Egg Live doing live mime. And so it was 4.5 minutes long, and it started with my introduction music, and then you could just hear all the sounds of what was going on
and
a lot of laughs.
Yeah.
And then it ended with me saying good evening, which is the first line of the show, about 4.5 minutes in. So and then that was the end of the CD.
You're such an ideas man, because the stuff is... Like, you know, all comics are kind of creative, like sort of more traditional stand-ups. We're kind of creating ideas and going, you know, have you ever noticed? Or here's a one-liner, or here's something else. But you, because you physicalise all your ideas, you always remind me of, like, you're a one-man A-team. Like, I've been in your workshop, where I believe there was a bazooka that you'd made.
Yes. And which, again, I've had to take overseas. That was fun.
Oh, my God. So you're someone who has an idea... Which comes first for you, the idea, and then you build a prop to physicalise the idea, or you see a funny thing, or you see an amusing... God, there's no good way to say it, but like you're walking through a hardware shop. Can you walk through a hardware shop and just think, hang on, plunger plus fried egg, and then you build a thing?
Well, I just thinking through the jokes that I do in my show... There's no rule. So I mean, there's been things which people have found and said, "Oh, maybe you could do something with this," and then I've turned it into a joke. And then equally, I've thought, actually, it would be great to walk on with a bazooka. So I've gone down to a hardware shop and bought drain pipes and road cones and paint and made a really convincing looking bazooka.
It looks great.
Which I was out on the front of our in front of our garage with it, getting some Nikki, my wife, to take some photos of me with it. And this really weird guy came over and started asking all about it and saying how he'd been on a firing range and shot guns. And we were trying to explain, look, it's made out of drain pipes. It's not real. And it was like he wasn't hearing that. He was just too excited about guns. It was all a bit A bit creepy, so we went back in.
Oh my god, so we went back in the house.
But, yes, and then other things I've, well, like you say, visualised the idea, come up with. So I've got a new thing where I've got a buffering sign and I wanted a... Have you seen that?
Yeah, I have seen that. Great.
And that, I'm so pleased with that. And I thought of that.
Can you describe it to us?
Yes. It is... I get someone with a mobile phone to video the stage and then I get out a big bit of black plastic with a stationary buffering sign, you know, the sort of flower petal kind of...
Yes, the Apple... You know. The thing that happens when your phone dies and reboots itself.
Exactly, yeah. And I get them to start filming and then I talk and freeze. And when I freeze, I rotate a thing behind the sign. I'm gesticulating here. No one can see. and the buffering sign rotates. And if the camera phone is at the right distance, it looks so much like it is actually buffering. It's great. I've seen some people have put it on YouTube and Twitter and things like that. And it really does look like it's buffering. And so, yes, that was an idea that I had. And then I thought, well, I've got to make it. So I looked for materials and worked out how I could do it.
Were you, I often ask my guests if they were a funny kid at school. Were you a sort of makey kid? Were you in the Scouts? Were you someone that, did you play with lots of Meccano? Where does the kind of hands-on approach? Because I know you brew your own beer and you make your own print.
I played Lego, not Meccano. I'm not that old.
Oh, Meccano.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Really?
I preferred the Lego, but I think...
Was it inherited Meccano?
Yeah,
probably. Oh, there you go, that's why.
Yeah.
Mm.
Did you have clay bricks that you would fire?
No, I wasn't particularly. I kind of got into being creative more... Well, I don't know, I was into art and things like that, but not really very makey, and I certainly wasn't in Scouts or... but I was into comedy, and I did little sketches and things in assemblies and music as well. I was into music and I did, I remember having these two Casio keyboards and doing a kind of interpretation of the A-Team theme in an assembly once. And looking back, yeah.
And were you, when you were doing sketches in assembly, that's a lovely, that is such a lovely idea. Just not the fact of school, but assembly, like presenting a thing to the rest of your school. Were you doing that? Was that solo? Were you doing sketches with friends? What was the setup?
It was with a guy called Phil Eisler, who ended up being Robbie Williams' bass player.
Okay.
And now is a film score composer in America.
Wow.
But me and him did. I mean, there were some of them we wrote ourselves, and some of them were things like the Oblivion Boys, you know, like the two policemen in The Young Ones, recreating that, just doing other people's sketches.
So you were kind of scratching an itch there in terms of making people laugh. Were you a happy kid? Were you a class clown type?
I wasn't really a class clown. I was definitely a happy kid. And then I joined a youth theatre, the Lewisham Youth Theatre, and did a few plays with them, and then started performing. If we're going to go, are we going to go into history now?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah. And then me and my friend Leo went to see Archaos, the French anarchic circus.
Yes.
Who were on Clapham Common, and we went to see that show, and it just, and that really was, I think, the catalyst for making me go, actually, this is what I want to do.
You literally saw a circus and went, wow, it kind of peeled your brain.
But I need the listeners to know that to say you saw a circus isn't what... Because you know, Archaos wasn't like
Archaos were like, they were the heavy metal circus. They were chainsaw, kind of not just chainsaw jugglers like you see people doing in the street now, but there were... Like, they were kind of insane. There were people running around with huge squares of corrugated iron on their backs.
Yeah, and it was... But again, it was all that sort of... that kind of creative, you know, welding things together, taking a car and cutting it in half and having a set of fell apart. And
there was a bus that... Was there a bus full of water?
No, there was a mini full of water. Covered in shells. And then with double windows. So it looked like it was completely full of water with this woman driving around in it. And it was just, and it was so genuinely dangerous and you know, properly anarchic, wasn't it? I mean...
How are you going to juggle a chainsaw? I'm just going to juggle a chainsaw.
Well, that's the thing, people did, and real accents. And in fact, when the first time I went to Edinburgh Festival, just as a punter, which must have been when I was 17, 18 maybe. And we went up to see our chaos up there, as amongst other things. And we were sat on the front row, and there was a car in the show which started by itself. And there was actually someone in the boot who was hot wiring it and said this car would start by itself and then people would get in it and drive off. And someone had left it in gear, and it started and it just drove straight into us. And there was a great big tractor tyre in between us and the car, which bashed into this. There was then a sort of metal kind of barrier railing thing, and the tractor tyre bent the railing right, you know, like within millimetres of our knees. And then, you know, someone got in the car and drove it off. And we just thought, wow, that was part of the show. And that was amazing. And then when we befriended them afterwards, and I ended up working there cooking, which is why it's all so connected.
Yes.
You know, with me doing the cooking now. These people came up to us who were in the show and said, my God, you know, we nearly killed you. You know, and that was a complete accident. It was so rough and dangerous.
How old were you when you saw our chaos?
16, 17, somewhere around about.
That's so funny, because I was 17 when I saw, and I don't think I've told this story on the podcast before. I've always wanted to keep it quiet because there is a secret element of it that's, it was Bike Boy that I saw.
Right.
You know, and I don't know, that will mean something to only like 0.5% of my listeners.
Yeah.
But I was at Stratford College doing A-levels and feeling like, damn, dude, I mean, I like theatre, but I don't really like going to see it. Do you know what I mean? Definitely, this was like me kind of going, hang on. And I was doing a juggling double act on sort of during the summers with my best mate, Noel. And then we saw a documentary about our chaos. And I remember everyone in the little terrapin out the back of the college. Kind of just, I was sat there just transfixed, like the kid at the beginning of the, you remember the opening credits of Dream On, where the little kid had just be sat there watching TV as the world streamed around him. I was completely like, oh, where can I go to this magical kingdom? And I remember seeing a lad from Bristol with a Mohican who was being interviewed, who was saying, oh yeah, I just rode into the ring on my bike and I started doing tricks on my bike.
I remember the documentary, because I remember him going, and I went in there, I'd done all my tricks, and some of them was really bad. That's what he said to me. And I did a bit of juggling, and they said, why don't you join us?
And
I remember that documentary.
Years later, having set me on a bit of a course, like, oh yeah, street shows and the circus, and maybe that. And then I kind of did a sort of 5 years voyage into circus stuff at that point, and clowning, and that's what kind of kicked off the clowning thing
for
me. I'd seen bits of stand-up. And then years later, I realised, oh God, that must have been Bike Boy, who's a street performer known to the world of street performing, who is... how can we describe him? He's a sort of... he's probably indescribable. He's famous in Australia. He used to be on Hey Hey, It's Saturday. And he's kind of an incredibly hypnotic performer. He's sort of boneheaded in a lovable way. And he is absolutely not the sort of person that you would think would have inspired the young Stuart Goldsmith. He's this kind of cerebral, kind of, you know, analytical comedy personality. So, but I think that's hilarious that we both, this is your episode, not mine. But
no, but it is. Well, I just remember when, I think the second time we met, and we just started talking and realised that although there's, you know, a kind of 5 year age gap, the path was almost exactly the same.
We were in the Isle of Wight,
and
we missed the ferry.
And we were in a car in the most torrential downpour.
And we sat in the car. Oh my God, well, that's lovely. That's one of those lovely, I'm forever banging on about the isolation of the circuit and stand up and how you can, you know, how it's difficult to make connections sometimes with people because you might meet someone at a gig and like them and then not see them again for 3 years. And you go, oh, if only we'd sat and, you know, we'd have forged a friendship out of it. That was one of those ones you go, oh no, the circuit can be brilliant for those kinds.
Oh, it can. And then, and if you get, you know, two nights somewhere or like when we've done gigs abroad or something like that, you know, and then you get these moments when, and if it's the right person, which it isn't always.
I will never forget driving to Maastricht, you driving me and Dan Evans to Maastricht. To do that Barnstormers gig, which is a very unusual gig in that it was in the Netherlands, but it was not to expats. It was to an entirely Dutch-speaking audience.
Yes, well, it was quite an international audience, really, wasn't it? Because it was in the university.
Yes,
and so they had a lot of, but certainly not expats.
They had brilliant English,
but
they weren't an English audience. So they're very different to a lot of the kind of European gigs. And we may as well, before we move on to the hotel survival... it only just occurred to me that it was during that I should share this game with my listeners. Do you remember we played No More Comedians?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my God! I might even have a list of it.
And also, We can tell the listeners of the Ultimate 20 Questions game as well, which we played. Did you remember that one?
Ah, let's start with that one and then I'll...
Okay.
Tell me that one.
Ultimate 20 Questions is just a brilliant game to play if you're on the road with other comedians. You've remembered
it. I do remember it. I don't think of it as that game. I don't think of it as that title, so right. I don't know what you mean. But explain the game to us, okay. It's great. I play this all the time.
What you do is, if you're on a road trip, or even if it's just a there and back in the same night trip, just be observant throughout the trip of the minutiae of the experience. And then, on the way home, you play a game where it's like ordinary 20 questions, but it has to... It doesn't have to be a person. It could be anything from a person to an object to a feeling to a moment to an emotion to a smell.
It has to be an incredibly specific moment from the trip.
Yes, from that trip, which you either... all experienced, or you assume you'll experience. So it could be the feeling of despair that I think you felt when we got to the gig and we saw the layout of the room and we both felt that neither of us were brave enough to ask the promoter to move all those tables and chairs forward. It's because we were tired and it was quite late and that sort of thing.
It's such a great tour game. It's so great. It's so great for the trip home. To think back, okay, was it inside or outside? Was it to do with the gig? Did it happen at the show? Was it while we were getting ready for the show? And it's amazingly, like 20 questions, it's amazingly possible to get those incredibly precise moments.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. And it's lovely when you get that moment when everyone else, which I suppose in a way is a bit like stand-up, is doing some kind of observational stand-up where, you know, when you hit on a moment that's very particular, yes, that other people wouldn't necessarily recognise, and you would go, yeah, I noticed that.
It's a more satisfying game when the specific moment you're referring to isn't something that's already been discussed.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
It has to be surprising. Yeah. The other game we played was a variation on, I mean, I know it as Mark Watson's game, but it's Watson, Horn and Key invented a game called, and I think the title is quite unfortunate, but the title's called No More Women. it's nothing to do with there not being any more women. But you take it in turns to name a famous person, and then that famous person necessarily will fall into a huge number of different categories. So you could say, the first one that occurs to me is C-3PO, no more robots. And then you would continue doing the game, but the categories get smaller and smaller because there are more and more things excluded. So no more robots, then, okay, Zola Butt, no more sports people, you know. And then it gets
so do you
smaller.
Play it that has to be famous? Because I've played it since, and then someone will say... name more famous people. And then you go, oh...
Exactly. Oh, there's all sorts of variations on it. But the variation we discovered on that Maastricht trip was no more comedians, which lends itself to an extremely bitchy and fun game in a car. I recommend this to anyone. If you're listening to this, travelling to a gig, have a bash at this game. You have to name a comedian that you all know, either whose work you're all familiar, you can know them personally or not, and then you get very specific things with, like, comedian X... no more people whose profile is greater than their talent. And it's great for it. I mean, I don't think of myself as a bitchy comic at all, but that game will absolutely draw out of me some startling true opinions.
So this is George. What a lovely man. I mean, he's so warm, such a funny performer, and so inventive. So, I mean... I guess, you know, all performers are inventive. We invent the stuff, we create the things. But I just love the way he just finds funny in absolutely anything. And I think his act most typifies, in some ways, the sort of the wibbly-wobbly world of the comedian, where you just look at the thing, see something funny, see it in a different perspective. His act absolutely breathes life into that and is just so much fun to watch. So do go and see Anarchist Cook at the Edinburgh Fringe. George is at the Gilded Balloon, and I'll be doing regular tweets and shout-outs and stuff with details. But listen, you can get yourself to Google more easily, I'm sure, right now than I can. And if you're going to be at Edinburgh, get up there and see George. I've had a few more donations come in, which is very, very kind of you. I really appreciate that. The new website is now online. We're going to be tinkering with it and tweaking it for months to come, I'm sure. But go and have a little butchers at www.comedianscomedian.com. We've got the new logo that you'll have downloaded with this episode and all sorts of other fun things there, many of which are gradually working more and more as we get there. But certainly chief among them is the donate button. So please feel free to support the show in any way you like. If you'd like to chuck us 10 or 20 quid, just a little something to keep the lights running, then that would be very much appreciated. Or if you'd like to see me at a gig, say something cool and press some cash into my hands, then please do that. Always keen to encourage that. And thank you to those of you that have. So your donations keep the show running, and they allow me to keep doing it and do crazy stuff with it, like taking myself to LA Podfest next September. There's some exciting things about that coming up, but I'm going to keep them to myself for now in the hope that they definitely come off. But yes, things like that. I wouldn't be able to do it. I wouldn't be able to afford the hotel there or the flight over without the support of people like you. So thank you very much to everyone that's donated recently, and the donate button at comedianscomedian.com is there for you. Let's get back to the brilliant George Egg.
We're talking about travelling in the day-to-day life of a comedian. That leads us nicely to hotel survival. So tell me how this came about.
Okay. I suppose about 5 or 6 years ago, was spending a lot of time in hotels just because of the makeup of the circuit meant that there were more Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights where you'd be stuck in a hotel for a couple of days. I am genuinely into cooking, and have been for since I was, you know, a late teenager, really into it. I mean, to the point that I do often entertain the idea of when I feel like I've had enough of this, of doing something that is solely to do with cooking, like having a cafe or something. So I started thinking about what I could cook in the hotel room using what they provide you with in terms of heating up equipment. So iron, kettle,
trouser press,
of course, Corby 5000. Genuinely out of thinking, well, I don't want to spend money on room service and I don't want to go out and buy junk food. Thinking, well, what can I cook in my hotel room? And the first thing, I don't want to say too much because there's so much of it in the show, if people want to come and see it. But the first instance was thinking, everyone likes warm pita bread and hummus. I'll iron the pita bread and see what happens. And it worked really well, and it puffed up and it crisped up a little bit on the outside. And then chopped it into fingers and had hummus and pita bread. And then once that worked, that just meant, you know, the creative sort of juices started flowing, and I just came up with more and more ideas, which I realised just for my own comfort, and then thought, I think it might have been a suggestion from another comedian, said, you know, why don't you film them? So I made three short films, one of which I uploaded to YouTube, which went reasonably viral, I suppose. I think it's had about 140,000 hits, so not too bad.
Yeah, not too shabby.
Which was me making tortellini in a kettle, and then making a sauce in the dish, in the soup plate that I got sent up from reception, and then made some fresh bread, which I rose the dough by balancing it on a towel on top of a tissue box under a halogen light. Oh no, it was balancing on top of a Gideon Bible, which was very biblical looking with the halogen light shining down.
Well,
making bread. Oh, I know. And I've got such a nice thing for that, which I'll come on to in a minute, for the Edinburgh show. And then formed muffins, which I toasted, because muffins are traditionally cooked on a skillet, on a like an arga, just on the hot plate. So inverted an iron between two rolled up towels, and cooked these muffins on top of the hot plate of the iron. So I made a few films and then kind of didn't really do anything about it for a while. Had a few meetings, like any other comics listen to this know that there's all these exciting prospect when you get meetings and you think, oh, this is going to happen, and then nothing does. So it wasn't until 2013. When, after doing a couple of years of Robin Ince's Christmas shows at the Bloomsbury Theatre, his godless shows, and doing sort of two or three of the run, I said to him, look, can I be part of the team for the next one, for the 2013 run, and do every show? And he said, yes, but can you come up with something different rather than the, you know, the variations on the prop stuff that I'd done before? So I thought I'd do a, because it's a kind of sciencey show, I thought I'd do a kind of illustrated lecture version of the cooking thing. And so I wrote a 10-minute piece where I was cooking pancakes on two irons that were inverted and supported by a trivet made of Gideon Bibles. And I've got a great story about how I got the Bibles. And that just went down really well. So then I thought, well, I'll turn it into a one-man show. And it's the first, because I haven't done it. As you know, I've been on the circuit for, I've been doing it for nearly 20 years. And I've never done Edinburgh. And I think, it's probably because I've had a family and I've kind of, I've always come up with various excuses for not doing it. But doing it this year for the first time, I think the main reason I'm doing it this year is because I really do feel that I've got something that I feel so much passion for. And actually writing this one-hour show was pretty easy. And the biggest job has been cutting it down to an hour because it's grown and I've come up with more and more ideas. So then I turned it into this one-hour show, George Agonicus Cook, which I did in Brighton at the Fringe in 2014. And then did another version, another shorter, a different 10-minute version in Robin Ince's Christmas shows last year. Then did it at the Fringe again this year, and it's sort of evolved, and then taking it to Edinburgh.
So I feel like we should get into some tougher questions about it now, because we've heard a lot of kind of this. We've got a picture now of who you are. Let's talk a little bit more about the having a family, not going to Edinburgh, staying on the circuit with an act that. Are you turning over a lot of material? Have you been turning over a lot of material prior to
on the circuit? No, yeah.
No.
No, I would say, I think that it's interesting because I think I've certainly for a long time I would fall into the category of acts who don't turn over much material, who've kind of got a pretty bulletproof 20 minutes, 30 minutes on occasion, but generally, closer to 20, which works and didn't really see a need for changing it, but was involved in family life, and I suppose that's where my creative needs were being focused on doing a lot of building in my house, and which I suppose is kind of similar to what I'm doing now in my show, but that's where the focus was, and so it was being creative there for my family. And now that they're all older, they're 14, 17 and 19 now. And so there's not that need. I think I've just focused my creativity on my show instead. And the same with my wife, with Nikki as well. She has just, I suppose she's an artist. She was a hairdresser. And for the last few years, we've been saying, if someone says, what does your wife do? We'd say, she's a hairdresser, but she does this kind of art stuff as well. And now actually she's making as much money from her art as she is from her hairdressing, more, in fact. And so we've got to that point where we're going, oh, she's an artist. And we were talking about it the other day and kind of going, well, I think it's coincided, both of our being creative again, with the kids growing up. I don't know if that answers the question, really. But
yeah, it absolutely. We're getting into it. I suppose what I'm interested in is during the period where you were creatively satisfied with being a dad,
yeah,
and working, building your house and the workshop and all the rest of it, how it felt to be in an environment, in a circuit environment, where other people were turning over more material. Did you sort of think, like, because I suppose because of the sort of the street performing background, we've only really sort of touched on, but I suppose someone like the other person who is of a similar ilk to you, I suppose, that I've had on the show would be Noel Britton.
Yeah.
And Noel's brilliant, and he's spent, 25 years turning his act into something that is indestructible, yeah. Titanium, And I wonder, I don't think I asked him at the time, but I wonder what it's like to see people growing around you and knowing that you're doing all of your growing at home. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you've been on the circuit for 20 years, you'll have been headlining at gigs where the open spot is now someone who plays Wembley.
Yeah.
So how did that feel to be? Did you sort of feel lucky to just be out there gigging? I know some people
some comics are sort of like, oh, you know, hey, I'm not working in a factory. This is success by my standards.
Yeah, I think I've never had that hunger for fame. I've never... So I've not, you know, looked at someone like Russell Howard, who exactly, you know, was going on first at a gig in Exeter when I was headlining maybe 12 years ago, and is now, you know, stellar. I've never looked at him and kind of gone, oh, that's not fair or anything like that at all. I think because Noel Britton's interesting, and I listened to Noel Britton's podcast, and I think that when he was talking, he kind of, his justification was there's two paths. There's one where you can, you know, be very prolific and come up with lots of stuff that might not be dynamite, or you can spend your life in that kind of old school way, honing one act so that it's perfect. And he kind of, he just seemed very content to do that. I don't think I was content doing that. I think I was oblivious to it because I was just focused on other things. And I think it was, and I really enjoyed doing it. I never got bored, and I still don't. And I'm, you know, I'm saying all this as if I don't still do the same 20 minutes, which I do, you know, a lot of my circuit act is unchanged from, you know, I mean, it's certainly, it's evolving much more rapidly than it has, you know, in the last few years.
Sure. I would assume that you get given more leeway to repeat the same material than an observational stand-up telling the same jokes.
Yeah, I think because my show is very much a show.
Yes.
It's yeah, absolutely.
You'll fit on any bill. Whoever else is on the bill, whoever else, you know what I mean? Unless it's Wes Zarek, John Lennon, and Noel Britton and you. But even that would be great.
It wouldn't be great. It would be a nightmare. And would I've it? Done that. Oh, I've done. There's been numerous occasions where someone has had the bright idea of going, oh, we thought we'd just have a variety night, and so then they've just booked spesh acts, if we're going to use the mid-90s term.
I love the word spesh.
and it's just been rubbish. I think it's, you know, it works so much better having being on with two more conventional stand-ups.
Gotcha.
But
very easy to book. Like if someone sat there looking at their diary and you get in touch, like their calendar of their own gig.
I'd say so, but I could give you a list of gigs that would disagree with you.
when you don't get booked for somewhere, when you're like, everyone's got certain gigs, they just go, that person just doesn't book me. Why do you think that is?
I think some of it is probably that they saw me early in my career. I think, you know, it's so hard to get that first impression out of someone's head.
Yes.
You know, I know there's people who would have seen me when I was just sort of making the transition from doing street shows to doing indoor stuff. And it was all very circus barkery kind of, you know, drawing everything out painfully long. And, you know, and I learned quickly that the approach to doing a circuit gig is, you know, the opposite approach to doing a street gig. But there was a period when I was learning that, when my show didn't really work very well indoors. And there'd be places that I tried to get into that would have seen that. And even if they've seen me since have a belter, you know, that's in their head kind of going, yeah, no, I'm not that. And I know I'm guilty of it too. There's people who I've seen the first time and sort of went, yeah, I don't think they're that good. And then even if they're, you know, going places, that's stuck in my head. And it's just human nature, I think, isn't it?
Mm.
So I think that's partly why. I think also there is, like you say, about the whole listenership thing of kind of being wary of saying, oh, he started out as a street entertainer or, you know, cooking in a circus or whatever. That there's that baggage, and I think that there's probably quite a lot of bookers who kind of go, yeah, no, we only book stand-up, and I want to grab them by the lapel.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
And go, now this is stand-up. I've just got some objects as well that I illustrate it with.
I mean, I remember in the early days of me emailing or probably ringing people to say, can I get a gig? No, it was. I was emailing rather than ringing. Just at the customer going, oh, this seems easier than it must have been in the old days. Oh, but because it's easier, everyone can do it.
Easy to ignore.
Yeah. But I remember proudly telling bookers, hey, listen, I've only done 50 gigs, but I've been a street performer for 10 years. And assuming that they would take that in the spirit in which I intended it, like, I've literally been making people laugh for a living for 10 years.
Yeah.
This is going to be fine. And of course, unbeknownst to me, they'd be receiving the email and go, you've done 50 gigs. And in fact, you're probably going to shout, draw things out, and all those other cliches associated with it, which is such a shame because I can sort of see their point, but I can kind of see my point as well.
Yeah. No, it's so difficult, isn't it? And you can't tell someone they're wrong. And you can't, you know what I mean? You've just got to, I suppose, wait for the moment when they are at a gig where you prove them wrong, or
yes,
someone who they respect enormously says to them, oh no, you've got him all wrong, you know, and then you get another chance. But it doesn't bother me. It bothers me a bit, you know, it bothers everyone a bit. You know, there's gigs you don't necessarily want to play, but you want it to be your decision.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But
that's very well summed up. Yeah, absolutely. So when it does, when you, and I've seen you, I speak as someone who has seen you just smash rooms up and down over and over again. When it goes wrong, are you stuck in a certain gear because the show is the show and the props are the props? Like if I feel that I'm tanking, I can go into the audience as an observational comic. I can go into the audience. I can talk to people, I can bounce off stuff, I can do stuff from a show 5 years ago because it makes me look clever because I've got something to say about something that's just happened. What kind of gears do you have
I've definitely got different gears. So I've got material that I think is a bit more intelligent and a bit more thought provoking, which I will, I suppose, omit if it's just the wrong sort of audience or they're not getting it. You know, there's stuff that's much more obvious and route one, I suppose, which I'll go to if they're really the sort of audience who I think. I mean, I can that opening 4.5 minutes of non-verbal comedy is a really good gauge for what the audience is going to be like, because there's a real variety of stuff in there, some of which is really stupid, and if they laugh at that, then that's kind of, I mean, that the opening gag with the tablecloth, where I, for the audience listening, I have a tablecloth with a pint of water on, and there's a mic lead left on the table, and I go to do the whipping the tablecloth off trick, and of course the people who are directly in the firing line, there's a laugh from their response to thinking they're going to get soaked with water, and then I take the mic lead off as if to say someone's left that on there, and then I take the glass of water off as if to say and that. And then do the tablecloth with nothing on.
Nothing on the
table. And that 9.8 times out of 10, or 98 out of 100.
Yeah, that's another way of saying it.
Works and gets, and that's a real point where I kind of go, okay, this is going to be fine.
Yes.
And then I know they're going to get, because the majority of what I like in the show, my favourite bits of the material are that kind of thought process of just stupid, considered stupidity. But then there's occasions when I do that and people just won't laugh at it at all. And then I think, well, it's going to be a struggle. And so I will, yeah, there'll be a sort of, it'll be mostly the same, but there'll be paths that I won't take and there'll be paths that I will because of that. And certainly more recently, I mean, when I did Glastonbury the weekend before last, I compared for the first time, which I've never done before.
Oh, you were in the Astrolabe?
Yeah.
Were you? Yes. Okay.
And that was, and you know, having done this for as long as I have and never compared, that was a real, that was really interesting and brilliant. I absolutely loved it.
I would think that you have got such a huge bank of material. Sometimes compare. What did you do? Let me know. I won't put words in your mouth. What was your experience of comparing?
Well, in the Astrolabe, which is the theatre tent at Glastonbury, it's very different to the cabaret tent where you compared, in that the shows are mostly not... Well, there's a lot of comedy there, but there's no stand-up. So there'll be some absurd Barcelonan clowns followed by a dance company, followed by the Steve Frost Impro All-Stars, and so on, and that sort of ilk. So you get a very different audience in there, a very family audience, complete mix of age ranges, and also an incredibly nice audience. So that made it, I think that made it a lot easier. So I didn't feel that jokes, well, I've learned pretty quick on the first day that jokes didn't work doing material, even trying to sort of slip material into what seemed like, you know, into conversing with them didn't work. What worked best was chatting with them, was actually getting off the stage, you know, walking into where the seats were, sitting on the seats, asking them what they've been up to and you know, and seeing what comedy came from that, but not pushing a kind of, I've got to make this funny. Actually just being friendly, nice, chatty, and then doing a few things. And there's a few, I do quite a lot of the Comedy Club for Kids shows and there's bits that I've written for my kids' version of the show that worked really well for that. There's a lot of illustrated practical jokes. And so that I suppose was material, and that worked well because I think because I was giving them something, I was sort of, you know, giving them something to take away in the form of, you know, you can recreate this yourself for your friends.
Yes.
But standing there doing as if I'm on stage at a circuit gig didn't work at all.
So persona-wise, who are you on stage when you do your regular gigs? And how are you different to George now sat on the sofa?
Well, again, you see, I really think I've changed a lot in the last kind of 3 or 4 years. Because certainly when I started out, I really thought, okay, I'm playing George Egg, I'm playing this character. Sort of this sort of confused, bumbling clown, I suppose, almost. And now I really feel like that. I used to have glasses on stage, and then there was a real turning point when I kind of went, I'm not going to wear the glasses anymore. And it was a real barrier thing, and changing and that changed my persona a bit. And I think, I don't know, I feel like I'm just a slightly amplified version of me now. And certainly in the Edinburgh show, the cooking show, that's just completely me. It was very, it's not very different. You'd have to ask someone who saw it more, but I feel like the cooking show is much more about me. It's just an amplified version of me. I don't feel like I'm playing a character on stage anymore at all.
But the cooking show, you feel, is much closer to actually being you.
Yeah, but again, very amplified. I mean, I get really, I don't know, if anything, it's more, I think because the cooking show is so hectic and so panicky, because I really am multitasking. I mean, I do cook a proper and really decent 3-course meal on stage.
In an hour,
on hotel equipment, whilst reciting an hour of written, you know, what I've been describing as something that falls in a Venn diagram where there's stand-up comedy, illustrated lecture and cookery demonstration. I fall into the bit where those three sets intersect. It really is, you know,
it's a hell of a niche.
Yeah. No one else does that, do they?
So now we're going to stop and you're going to cook me some lunch using the equipment that you would find in a normal kitchen.
I am. I'm afraid it's going to be very conventionally cooked, but it's going to be nice.
We'll launch straight back in. Tell us what we've just described to my listeners, the delicious meal that we've just eaten.
Okay, it was some very slow-cooked pulled lamb shoulder. Which we had in a flatbread with some tahini dressing, some hummus.
Was it homemade tahini?
The tahini dressing was homemade, tahini with lemon juice and stuff, garlic and water and so on. A bit of sumac.
You weren't out smashing tiny tahinis with a Bible.
No. Tahini.
I have no idea what tahini is.
Snaring tahinis in my tahini trap. Sesame seeds tahini.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah.
Ground sesame seeds.
I knew
that. Or are you? And some coriander and chilli chutney.
Very nice.
And some other salad-y things and some mint in there.
Tell us about the Turkish delight. I'm just going to close the window because it's been outside.
We had some elderflower delight, which is such a great thing. It's just, depending on when this goes out, it might be too late or just in time. To still get some elderflowers and make this, but it's like Turkish delight, but made with elderflowers.
Well, I wanted to get this out in time that people can listen to it and go, oh, let's go and see his Edinburgh show. So I will also prioritise the elderflower season. So listen, we've had a lovely meal. It was delicious. It was great. We've had a lovely meal. We are now relaxing with a glass of wine.
Cheers.
Cheers. And I could get to like this format for the show. But now, so we're going to get into the... it's real talk. It's post... This is whiskey and cigar post-prandial time. So let's talk about your expectations for Edinburgh as someone who has... Have you been up before? Or you've never even been up?
I've been up as a visitor. Mm-hmm. I've never been up in any capacity as a performer. I've not been part of a package show or anything. Been up. Last time I went was, I think, the second year that Will Smith took his show there.
Yep.
And I stayed with him and went to see a load of shows. And that's got to be 9, 10 years, maybe?
Yes.
8, 9 years?
Yes, something like that.
Long enough.
So what do you want to get out of it? Let's talk about what you want and let's talk about what you think is realistic. What would the perfect Edinburgh be for you?
I think...
And you don't need to give an honest perfect Edinburgh.
Well, I suppose absolutely, you know, stupid, unrealistic perfect Edinburgh would be that someone came up to me and said, we love this cooking show. You could be on TV doing something to do with cooking, not necessarily cooking in hotels, but you know, I suppose what would be ideal would be that they would see the genuine passion for what I'm doing up there as far as in culinary terms, and my way of performing and talking about it. And then I'd get a TV series where I was allowed to, you know, do whatever cooking I wanted in whatever capacity all over the world, something like that. That would be the ideal one. Sort of realistic ideal Edinburgh for me would be that I get reasonably well attended shows with people coming up afterwards saying I really enjoyed that, because that's when I've done it so far, when I've done it in Brighton and elsewhere. But Brighton, both in the 2014 and 2013 fringes, were really successful in that they were well attended, but chiefly that I got so much feedback from people afterwards, and people are, you know, enjoying the creativity of it, but also in literally saying that was really funny, really enjoyed it, but that sea bass, how did the sauce that went with that, you can just remind me, you know. So it just felt like I was hitting people's interest on a lot of levels, and a realistic Edinburgh expectation is not that I get a 5-star review or that I get a TV series, but that I get enough people coming and enjoying it. And I think from what I've heard from other comedians and other performers who've done it, that that feels like a reasonable expectation.
Yes, I think so. It's, you never know, because it's your first one. You don't have an existing fan base, necessarily.
No, sure.
You've been gigging for 20 years to people who will recognise your face on a poster.
Possibly. Do you think? Maybe. I don't think even that, really. I mean, I think being a circuit comedian, no one knows who you are, do they? I mean, people come along to see... What's been so exciting the last couple of years, doing this one-man show, is when I've sold tickets and I've known these people are coming to see me do this. And that's just been the best thing. And so, but I think people who know me or who know my show from the circuit, I don't even know if that's a thing, or it would be so few people, you know, that it's irrelevant. I can't imagine there's... I think that there might be people... I think I might have built up, or I'm certain I've built up, just from the sort of comments on Twitter and the fact that, you know, I sold well in Brighton, that there are people out there who now know that I do the cooking thing. And so I think I've got a reasonable amount of following from that. But, I mean, it's still going to be peanuts.
I think the strongest element of it is that you've got a really unique, original angle. And I think that people will look at it and go, anarchist cook, what is this?
Yeah.
And what time are you on?
2:45.
I think that's
lunchtime.
Edinburgh lunchtime, yeah, 2:45, yeah.
A nice relaxed late lunch.
I can't see it not working. I think it's, and you're in that position as well, whereby most of the other people who are up there doing their first hours will either be canny people who waited for ages, but still only by ages, I mean like 5 years before doing one, or probably tens or maybe hundreds of people who are doing their first hour who are just face-planting into the festival and go, let's get this hour out there.
Yeah.
I spoke to someone called Lydia King recently. I saw her at ARG Festival, and I've not seen her work. She was comparing there. She, I think, has done maybe less than 10 gigs, but she's doing an hour, but she's an actress. So she's done 7-hour-long shows already. Yeah. So she's approaching it in that. So everyone's doing it from vastly different sorts of directions with vastly different expectations. I mean, it's not quite that you're going to be the Mickey Flanagan of this year, you know, someone who's been at the top of the circuit for 15 years going up and winning the newcomer award or, you know, getting nominated for newcomer.
Well, I think with mine, I think the difference, and I think this is what's attracted me to doing it, is I think a lot of people of my vintage or whatever, if they hadn't done it for this long, would go up there with kind of going, okay, well, I'll just get the best of everything that I've done so far. Whereas mine, there might be maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes of material in the hour that I've ever done in club gigs.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, it's completely different. It isn't, I mean, it is, there's stand up in there, but like I said before, it's quite not theatrical even. It's, you know, it crosses all these different sets of theatre and lecture and comedy. And I think that's what makes it...
Is it sort of, are we approaching TED Talk kind of territory?
I suppose...
Should you be doing it at culinary festivals or...?
I'd love to. I tell you what I'd really want to do. And if they're listening, or friends of them are listening...
For the benefit of the listener, Egg has just stretched out on the sofa and got himself comfy.
there's an event in Copenhagen called MAD, which is Danish for food. And it's basically like a TED conference, but it's all about food. And they have just amazing stuff. They've got just straight chefs doing lectures. Lectures sounds boring.
Straight chefs, by which you mean chefs. Like everyone else apart from you. I got more of you than your bog standard chefs.
And then they had I've forgotten her name, but the Scottish schoolgirl who did the blog about her school dinners.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
And they had her and her father doing a talk. And then there's this amazing, and I've forgotten his name, this amazing Italian butcher who is so charismatic, and he's really stocky, and he's got totally gelled back black hair. And he, to this, I think it's to a bit of AC/DC at the start, he's quite old, he has a pig hanging from a chain,
Oh my God.
On stage, and he comes onto this AC/DC track, and he guts the pig, and he just pulls all the insides out, and it's amazing. It's so incredible. And then he gets all the guts on this big butcher's block, and then the music finishes, and then he does this sort of lecture come life story, which in Italian, being translated by his American wife. And then at the end, he does a bit from Dante's Inferno. Is it Dante's Inferno?
Mm-hmm.
Which he doesn't translate, and he just does it in this sort of operatic, booming theatrical voice.
Oh my God!
And it's just, and it's where you can look, if you look on the Mad Symposium website, you'll find a video of him, and it's, the set is fantastic. The set for the year that he was doing is like a clearing in the woods, and they've got all this grass and logs and things on stage. Yes. And then all black background everywhere else, and just beautifully lit, like a good TED conference. So
have you got to raise your game then, in light of that, given that there are other people doing incredibly weird and wonderful things in the world of culinary demonstration?
I don't know if I've got to raise my game, because I think still within that field, it's what I'm doing is unique.
Yes.
No one's doing okay,
he's not funny. Cook.
Oh, he's funny as well.
Oh, is he funny?
But no, I mean the fact that I'm doing hotel room cookery. So,
Well, here's a question. If this year is if it's anywhere above halfway successful, like if it's a smash, if it works out for you,
yeah.
And a producer says, we need another one, what's your next idea?
Well, here's a funny story. I had a meeting with a woman from a TV company, about a year ago, and she was saying that she really liked all the cooking in hotels idea, and said, you know, I think it would be a nice idea for a series would be to take it into other environments where it would be, you know,
cooking underwater.
Anyway, one of the ones that she cited was cooking in prison, and I said, I've got to stop you there, because that is one of the suggestions that Alan Partridge comes up with when he's flailing around trying to think of things. And there's the You Foster Them with Chris Eubank and Cooking in Prison and Monkey Tennis.
Oh my God.
So we had a laugh about the fact that she'd suggested
a genuine Partridge idea. That's wonderful. You could see it working though, in the context in which we're talking.
Well, actually, I did
Moonshine in Barracks.
Well, I did a preview of this in Northampton. At the NN Cafe, do you know that? Lovely venue.
No, I don't.
And there was a guy in the audience there who came up to me afterwards and said, I work in prisons, and that's what prisoners do. They do lots of cooking in prison, you know, utilising, you know, in the same way that I'm doing in a hotel, basically saying, you know, that's another avenue you could go down. So funny as it is in the Partridge thing, actually, I think it would be a really interesting sort of documentary to learn about how people survive inside.
So what other kinds of, what other shapes could you do it in? Could you do, yeah, prisons could work, couldn't it?
Yeah, prisons, I suppose, students, camping, festivals. There's lots of, I mean, they're all, you know, they're a bit more pedestrian in that, you know, whereas cooking a hotel room is a bit more anarchic and cooking at a festival is
just
practical.
Yes, a bit more subversive, isn't it?
But I suppose the thing is that...
Cooking on your knees whilst driving. Can you do that?
I suppose this, you know, this, while it's fun, the cooking in the hotel, and it's all creative, I suppose as far as if what you're talking about is kind of it being a calling card to TV people to say, it's kind of going, look, this guy is animated and passionate.
He's a funny chef. A chef who's coming at it from the funny angle rather than a chef trying to be funny. You're a funny guy being a chef.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose that then if, you know, we were entertaining the idea of me becoming a TV star, then it would be that they'd be looking at me going, oh, right, well, he's animated and interesting. Yes. And so actually, if he can translate that into cooking at a festival or just cooking at home and kind of go, I mean, I like the idea of a programme that's just about cooking at home, a realistic. I've got this idea. I think it's a great idea. Can I say an idea that then without it being nicked?
I don't know. Why don't you tell me and then say it in a short sentence and we'll bleep it if I think it's nickable.
Okay. The idea is...
You can't possibly do that. It's a brilliant idea. You can't possibly tell people that.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that would really work, don't you? I
mean, absolutely.
To talk about it without anyone knowing what
it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think
that
the problem is that The first of those two things that I'm saying should be combined are so sanitised.
Yes.
And the second, there's so much empathy.
Yes.
And so, you know, you get people watching it going, yeah.
That is anyway, a great idea. Okay, so let's not talk about the idea. Let's talk about this. This is a tougher question. Do you have the ambition to make that happen? Do you have the drive to put into it? Now your kids are grown up. If a producer chats to you, do you think you can hit that with enough kind of dynamism and verve and go, I'm the guy that's going to make this happen? Or are you, here's the question, are you too old?
In my eyes, I'm not. When it comes, I mean, if I had a meeting with someone about, do you want to make a comedy programme? Then I think I wouldn't have the passion. If someone said to, I think, you know, in 10 years' time, if someone said to me, do you want to make a programme about cookery? I will come with such passion and dynamism that, you know, But I might be too old, just as far as, you know, people in TV seem to not be attracted to people who've got greying beards.
Mm.
But as far as in my head goes, I don't think when it comes to cookery and performing with passion that, then I think it would be dynamite.
It's such a great niche.
I think so. But it's so in, isn't it? Everyone's into cooking these days. But, yeah, I don't know.
So this is a question I often ask of my guests. Review yourself. Can you review yourself as honestly as possible?
Reviewing myself in the capacity as George Egg anarchist cook, or review myself as in George Egg?
As in the circuit show, because obviously the anarchist cook show, that's sort of yet to officially drop. And, you know, people will be listening to this who are more likely, I think, to have seen your club sets over the years.
Oh, God, that is hard, isn't it, then? Review myself, I suppose. I don't know. It depends if it's someone reviewing me who's seen me lots, or if it's someone who's reviewing me, watching me for the first time.
It's you, so you've seen you lots.
Oh, God. Just, I think it's too difficult because I don't know, I suppose a show of which 50% is tried and tested, albeit maybe a little bit tired, and 50% of which seems incredibly fresh and interesting and entertaining and original. And, yeah, I know that the new stuff, other acts have observed when they've watched me and they've just said, God, the new stuff works well. And I think it's because it's new and it's because I enjoy doing it because it's new. And I'm kind of going, oh, this is nice because this is really, you know.
Is there a danger with some of your stuff that's, and I don't think it's right to call it tired, but is there a danger that some of it has become kind of careworn, where something definitely works and it's a banker you've been using for 20 years? Like what's the oldest joke in your club set? And I mean old. Yeah. I mean old as in what's the one that you've done the most times, the most often?
I guess that opening 4.5 minutes of non-verbal stuff, because that hasn't changed at all.
And does that? I mean, it does. That is a great argument then for the sort of the chronology not mattering, because people see it for the first time and it doesn't seem old or tired. It doesn't seem stale. It seems really lively.
No, I mean, there's bits where I suppose if I get a gig and it says 40 minutes,
yeah,
where
right.
I kind of go, all right, well, I'll have to drag that out.
It's very different the way people approach comedy these days, isn't it? I was going to say this earlier on. I think you are of an age of a comic where it seemed to me that most people started comedy 20 years ago. Most people who started comedy 20 years ago did so either because they had a burning political point to make,
yeah,
or they kind of wanted their life to be alternative and a bit of a DOS. Do you know what I mean? In the way that people don't tend to start like that nowadays. Or maybe they do, but they're pretending to have ambition.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone these days starting, you know, the target, the market is so much bigger. The target is so much more precise. I want to sell out Wembley and make £1 billion.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't start in a world where that seemed a remote possibility.
No, not at all. I never even started. Well, that's the thing. I don't feel like I ever did. I never felt like I'm gonna do this as a career. So I'd started doing the street entertaining when I was still in the sick form, and then I did that at weekends when I was at university, and then started getting a bit of, you know, contracted street work, and then did an open spot out the creek, and then realised that I couldn't do the indoor stuff and the outdoor stuff at the same time because they were too different, and made a conscious decision to just do the indoor stuff. But it was such a drifting into it. There was never any. And then Nikki got pregnant with our first child. And so I sort of thought, all right, well, I better make enough money at this. So blitzed more open spots just so that I could try and actually make the circuit pay. And then I suppose, yeah, just sort of drifted into it. And in fact, this is what we were going to talk about earlier. I was saying, I think I'm definitely a creative person. And I think that's, like I was saying earlier, when, you know, as far as doing stuff in the house goes and being a sort of creative father, and now that being a more redundant role, I think that the fact that the circuit is contracted, I think there are people who got into it because they're creative, and I think I fall into that. But I think then I got complacent. Well, not maybe complacent, but like I said, my creative focus was elsewhere, and so the show was working and I was enjoying doing it and I was getting booked, and so it didn't matter that I wasn't being particularly creative with it. And I think the contraction of the circuit has meant that people, the ones who went into it who were creative in the first place, are finding themselves in a position where they're kind of going, they're forced into being creative again, and either they're really enjoying it like I am and they're going, this is great, this is reminding me why I started doing this in the first place. Or they're the ones who got into it just purely as a kind of, oh, I can see a bit of a formula here and I can make it work and I can get a weekend's work and I don't have to do a real job. And I think, and I hope to, without being sort of sounding like I'm being too mean, but I hope that it kind of squeezes those people out because they kind of go, well, I don't have that creative urge. And without it, I'm not going to get noticed, then I'm just going to drift off. And they're the ones who are going to start, you know, doing a bit of labouring for their brother-in-law or driving a minicab.
that's a very bleak, very bleakly specific image.
I think that's fair. I think there are two reactions to the challenge of the circuit is contracting. And one of them is work harder then.
Yeah.
And the other one is complain about the circuit contracting.
Well, I suppose there's three. There's work harder then, there's complain about the circuit contracting, or there's go and do something else.
Mm.
You know? But just going, well, I used to do, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday weekends, blah, and now I'm not. It's like, well, create something else. Mm. You know, be either create something else outside or create something else within it, and you know, come up with something that people will go, oh, well, we want that. That's not we need an act.
This is what me and my friend Pete Dobbing, who's now on the circuit, mm. You know Pete, we used to say when all the new dads would be all the dads at the draw at Covent Garden at 8 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, and they'd be going, oh, come on, I didn't come out high enough, I've got kids. And me and Pete, we wouldn't say the 3 months faces, but we would probably go, well, do something else then. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, do something that doesn't rely on you getting to enjoy yourself for an incredibly small number of minutes a day.
Yeah.
And not have to really do any work. I hope one day I rue that. I have my own children. I go, God, that was stupid. I understood nothing. But there, you know, it's sort of, is it a privilege, do you think, to be able to be a performer?
I don't know. What do you mean?
I don't know. I was thinking that's a clever question, Stu. You've never asked that. Makes a change from the old, are you an artist or are you an entertainer? Is it a privilege to be able to be a performer? Yeah. Do we deserve to all be making $100,000 a year and doing double ups Thursday to Sunday and all the rest of it?
I think, you know, as a comedian.
By no means making $100,000 a year. I use that as an example.
That's like Partridge in the. When they say the end, I remember you've been on the phone, Alan. Oh, I don't care.
No, I think I used that because it came to my head recently in a conversation about the old days, like 15 years ago. I think a good headlining comic, I have guesstimated,
yeah,
without TV, could be doing 75 to 100 grand a year because there are lots of weekends that are £1,000 weekends back then.
What was the question again?
Is it a privilege?
Is it a privilege to do it? I think, yes, that's what I was going to say, is that as someone who sees loads of comedians, yes, there's comedians who I watch who I kind of go, God, it's not fair that you got the success that you've got.
Yeah.
And others who I
name
think...
Name them. No, definitely.
I'll write them down. Hey?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah.
That's quick.
They've got a very short name. No one.
I didn't. Listeners, I pretended to write down on a mimed piece of paper with a mimed pen, didn't I? I didn't say anything or write anything down. And then equally, there's ones who I'll think, God, you should have more success. So I don't know. It doesn't really answer the question, does it? But I think that...
How do you think, you're viewed on the circuit?
I don't know. I think I'm liked generally. I mean, I think I'm nice in dressing rooms and I'm very friendly and I'll, you know, make a point of asking people what they're up to, not tell them what I'm up to all the time.
That is a very rare talent.
I just know what it's like, you know, on the receiving end of someone coming in just going, oh, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. So I would hope I'm liked. As far as viewed as an act, it's just too subjective. So I know that I know there'll be people out there who go, oh, I think it's brilliant. And there'll be other people out there who'll go, I don't know why it even gets work, you know. It's too subjective to... It depends on the person.
If you were retiring to another dimension and you needed to train someone up to play the role of George Egg, what would you advise what's the advice that you give them?
Crikey. George Egg the comedian or George Egg the...
Both.
Everything.
George Egg the everything. Great Edinburgh title.
Oh, God, it's such a difficult question. I don't know. Enjoy it, I suppose, really. That's so trite, isn't it? But I think you... I'll stop doing something if I don't enjoy doing it. And there were, I suppose there was probably, this isn't really answering the question at all, this is just me talking, but anyway, but there was a period maybe, I don't know, 6 years ago, 5, 6 years ago, when I didn't nearly give up, but I certainly seriously entertained the idea of giving up and just thought, and I think that, I don't know, I'd start doing a little bit of teaching and I hated doing that and that reminded me how good this is. And then when I kind of put more focus into doing this, and then it's kind of since then that's when I started doing the Hotel Survival film, and that's when I did the shorter version, and since then I've done lots of, this sounds like a plug, but I've done lots of other things since then, like started doing a blog with another guy, and I made a short film that is in the Edinburgh show, and so just lots of different sort of creative pies, having my thumbs and fingers in, and so I suppose if you feel a twinge of I don't like doing this anymore, just get creative without worrying about the outcome, maybe something like that. Does that make sense?
That's a great answer.
But I think that's the thing. I think that so doing the short film and doing the blog that I do with a guy called Matt Lincoln, who's a photographer. And he's another dad of similar age kids, and I think a lot of the writing is nice. I'm really pleased with a lot of the writing, and it's sort of comical in a kind of newspaper sort of supplement article, kind of lightly sort of amusing. But we started doing that purely because we thought our kids we both do most of the cooking in our houses, and we just thought, well, our kids are going to grow up and they're going to want to know, how do you make that ragu? How do you make that whatever else? So we thought, well, we'd just start doing this blog where we take it in turns roughly every week to write a blog piece with a recipe of what we've been cooking so that they've got a record to go back on. And now we've got a lot of people who read it. But we didn't do it thinking, oh, we'll write this and then that'll become a TV program or that'll become, we just did it because we thought, well, that would just be a nice sort of way of forcing a bit of creativity once a fortnight, a bit of, you know, kind of sort of 400 or 500 word bit of writing that we've got to come up with. And similarly, I've been doing this show in Brighton called Joe Neary and Friends, which is which we've actually stopped doing now, but that was a monthly show. And again, it was just, and it wasn't, we weren't making any money from it at all. I mean, sometimes we might get 10, 11 quid, but mostly it went on the publicity for it. But again, it was just being creative without thinking, oh, there's going to be a TV programme called Joe Neary and Friends at the end of this. Just thinking this is a way of feeding that creative appetite that I think people who've gone into this for the right reasons have, and maybe lose for a while, which I think everyone is guilty of. And I think certainly I did for a larger period some years ago, which has been re-nourished.
No one on the show has ever spoken before about doing a different job for a bit and realising why you love this one. I think that's really, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, not that it's advice per se, but I think that's really good advice. I think actually just to remind yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't stop doing it. I was just doing like, you know, a couple of mornings at a university a week. But it was just so disheartening. And it made me realise, my God, this is just so, this is, I mean, I think that's the thing. I think that you forget is that you've got this opportunity every time you go on stage to do exactly what you want, you know. And yeah, you might push it too far and not get booked at that venue again. But for that 20 minutes when you're on stage or however long you're booked for, it's totally up to you. It's this completely open, creative
forum. We get a bit bored of the freedom, don't we? Get a bit inured to it. You say, oh, it's just a gig. And you go, no, from the perspective of people in the audience, let alone you, the performer, this is magic time, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And that can become a little bit careworn, even if the act hasn't.
Yeah.
I got quite deep at the end. I liked it. Thanks, George.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So that was George. Thank you so much to him for coming along. Thanks for my lunch. That was a lovely lunch. Cheers, Georgie. And do get along and see his show, Anarchist Cook, at the Gilded Balloon at this year's Edinburgh Fringe, which I believe he opens on something like the 5th or 6th of August for previews for the first 3 days. And then it's the rest of the month of August. Of course, you can come and see my show there as well. It's called An Hour. That is at 4:55 daily at Cannon's Gate, which is a pub on a street called Canongate. Canongate on Canongate. Yeah, that's correct. It's almost as if it's deliberately set to confuse outsiders. Who knows? Perhaps it is. You can come and see that. That's on every day apart from the middle Wednesday, where I shall be hightailing it to the Highlands and escaping the festival for 46 hours. Can't wait. And in the rest of the time for the second fortnight, I'm going to be doing live comedian recordings with people such as, I mean, the first burst is unbelievable. John Lloyd, then Catherine Ryan, then Tommy Tin, and don't miss those. Then there's one day we're missing. And then straight through to the end of the run. Those are all happening at Black Medicine, underneath Black Medicine, which is a coffee shop on Nicholson Street, corner of Nicholson Street and Drummond Street, at the Edinburgh Festival. And they will, when those shows are on, I think they're on, what are they, 10:55, 11, something like that. Have a little Google. Put it into Google. Edfringe.com. You can find out all the details on the Comedians Comedian Podcast Live with an absolutely staggering array of guests. Now, I just don't know how I'm going to get these next few episodes out, so leave that with me, and I will speak to you very soon. Possibly I'll start chucking them out twice a week for a couple of weeks to make sure everyone is out and up and running before we go into Edinburgh. Thanks for listening. Thanks to George. I've been Stuart Goldsmith, and this episode was co-produced by Nathan Wood. Speak to you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.